Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, so, hey.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Shea, where we answer your questions, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live, where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archives from past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Shea.
Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday, Arthur. Welcome, everyone. What topics do we have on tap this week, Arthur?
We have a great set of questions on philosophical underpinnings of fixed versus growth mindsets, John Galt's motor, acting rightly, and more.
So, folks, if you're listening live, you can post questions and comments in the text chat that is over at philosophyinaction.com/live.
Any news this week before?
Before we get started.
Before we get started. Stop moving the notes.
Sorry. Used to Greg, who knows everything. So here I am. We're all at AtlasCon, and I'm actually in front of a live audience, and Greg is not here because he's wrong and bad for not coming to AtlasCon.
He needs to listen to the answer to our third question about acting right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I would agree with that. And anyway, so I'm here with Arthur, who's my usual stand-in host for Greg these days. And we're having a great time here at AtlasCon. And so I just want to mention for folks who have never been to AtlasCon before, this is a annual Objectivist conference in Atlanta over Memorial Day weekend, which is super fun. And so if you're not here this year, by all means, please do plan to come next year. And that's it. That's all that's been going on, which is quite enough. And so let's get started answering the questions. Oh, you know what we don't have? Hang on. We need to conga, and I have forgotten about arranging for that.
I have to get back in
India. No, we do. We do actually have the conga in here. Here we go.
Question one, philosophical underpinnings of fixed versus growth mindsets. What are the philosophical underpinnings of growth versus fixed mindsets? At SnowCon, we discussed the negative impact of the doctrine of original sin on Western culture over breakfast one morning. We saw that this idea, which tells people that they are hopelessly flawed by nature, could encourage fixed mindsets. In contrast, an Aristotelian understanding of virtue and vice as dispositions cultivated by repeated action would seem to promote a growth mindset. What other philosophic ideas might tend to promote a fixed versus a growth mindset?
So this is a good question. I think it's also a difficult question because it's basically an empirical question, and I'm not a research psychologist, so this is not something that I've investigated. So I think what folks should consider is that my answer here is very preliminary. I'm making some suggestions based on some philosophical reasoning, but it's basically more of a proposal, a way of starting the discussion, a way of getting you guys thinking about what might be the philosophical beliefs or just the beliefs in general that are underlying any fixed mindset that you might have versus growth mindsets, and you know, see where that goes.
So for folks who aren't familiar with fixed versus growth mindsets, do you want to give us a quick overview?
I do. So mindset here is a technical term. It refers to a set of beliefs about the nature of a person's, particularly one's own, skills or qualities. And basically the question is, does the person believe that a particular aspect of yourself is just fixed by nature and immutable, and you can only do so much with it, and that's that? Or can these qualities, can these skills, knowledge, or whatever else that you have, can this be cultivated and grown and developed? Can you do better? Does putting in more effort make a difference? And so we can see this with the example of intelligence. A fixed mindset would hold the view that intelligence is static, and that therefore the goal is, look, I'm not out there to make myself smarter. I'm just out there to like look good, to display my intelligence. If I have this view, I'm going to avoid challenges that might show failure and be embarrassing to me. I might easily give up when I face obstacles. I might see effort as something that's not worth putting in because look, I'm just as smart as I am, and that's all there is to it. If somebody would give me feedback about, let's say, here's how you can really do better on this kind of test, I go like, what's the point? It doesn't matter. And I would be threatened by the success of others because there's just kind of a ranking of natural intelligence and you know, everybody who's above me, they're all a threat to me. On the other hand, if you have a growth mindset about intelligence, you would have this view that intelligence can be developed. And so you'd have a desire to learn and learn how to use your intelligence better, learn how to cultivate that, learn how to develop that. You would want to face challenges. You'd want to see, like, I want something a little bit more difficult. Let's try to stretch myself. In the face of obstacles, you would persist. You would put in that effort because you would see effort as something that's worth exerting. You would want to take in criticism. You'd want to take in constructive feedback. And you'd also, if there were other people who you would see out there who were more intelligent than you, you'd be excited by that. Like, wow, maybe I can get up to that level instead of thinking, oh, well, they're just a threat. I don't want to know anything more about them. Now, this is not to deny that people don't have natural limits. I'm sure that there's some component of intelligence which is either genetic or innate or just wherever you are in your life, you know, might not be that you can be Albert Einstein in the next 10 minutes. Right? So it's not saying that people don't have natural limits. But the question is, what can you do with your capacity that is given to you? Is that something that you can develop? Is that something you can cultivate? Is that something that you can make better or make better use of? Or is it just, well, you get what you get and that's that? So your mindset is about your attitude towards your potential, not whatever potential you might actually have.
So what kinds of philosophical ideas might incline a person toward a fixed or growth mindset?
So I have a bunch of ideas here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, that I want to talk about. But I want to see from the audience, do you have any thoughts on ideas that would make a difference in fixed versus growth mindsets? What kind of philosophical ideas might underlie fixed versus growth mindsets? I think this is a hard question, by the way. When we first started discussing this, I was like, it's one of those panic moments for me where I'm like, oh, crap, I have no idea what I'm going to say. So... Any thoughts? Dead silence. I'll give you a few seconds. Earl.
Just seems like very generally, if you have a deterministic philosophical, you know, point of view, you're gonna be led towards a fixed mindset generally.
That's my number one on my list is determinism. And so I'll say something more about that. And while I'm talking, you all can keep thinking about other options. So I think definitely a fixed mindset is going to be something that's promoted by a belief in determinism. Any view that, like, I can't overcome my genes, my environment, that's just the way I am, that's just it. I can't do any better. And so this could be just, like, you know, sort of leftist social determinism. It can be what you see more on the right about, well, it's God's plan, it's original sin. All these kinds of views are deterministic. Or it can be this sort of more neutral view that your life is in the hands of fate or it's in the hands of luck. And so, like, there's just so much you can do. Like, there's just very little you can do here.
Yeah, something I think that is very common on college campuses is this idea of, oh, the patriarchy or institutional racism and so on, and I'm just this helpless victim, and so it's not worth my even trying because there's some kind of ceiling that's imposed
right
on me.
And you can have a view, in fact, that there is institutional racism out there, but there's a difference between that and the view that you're determined by institutional racism and you can't possibly overcome it. So there would be a difference there. Another way that a fixed mindset, another kind of form of determinism here, would be this view that a person just has a kind of fixed intrinsic essence, that they're really not capable of changing. And Arthur, you suggested that this could be related to personality theory.
Yeah, so even though I think we're all super excited, especially in recent years, about personality theory, and everybody's very quick to pin themselves as, I'm an ENFJ, or, you know, I'm a high D, high C, or whatever. I mean, if you misunderstand the meaning of that, you can be seduced into thinking that's just the way I am, and I can't act beyond those constraints.
Yeah,
I can't be a different way.
Right. I think there are certain limits. Like, I don't think I could never become an extrovert, but I can. I think I can push myself in a more extroverted direction, and I can certainly choose to go out more. Whether or not it makes me, you know, tired and wears me out is another matter. But I can certainly make those kinds of choices. I can push myself to be more social. And in the same way, I think a lot more is malleable there than people might.
Yeah, just because you're a high D, high C doesn't mean you can't take into consideration other people's feelings.
Yes, that's very true. That's very true. Basically, I think here, anything that diminishes a person's sense of their power and their control over their life, their responsibility for their life, is going to promote a kind of fixed mindset as opposed to a growth mindset. So obviously, in contrast, the growth mindset requires a belief in the efficacy of your own thinking, your own choices. Like, there's, you know, if you think, look, what I do here, what this effort that I put out is going to make a difference, then yeah, that's a kind of fundamental of a growth mindset right there. And this is where this Aristotelian theory of virtue, I think, really makes a difference. And I'm not going to talk much about what that means, but Aristotle's idea is, look, like there's this training process whereby you inculcate certain habits and dispositions in yourself by always aiming at doing the right thing. And it's this gradual process where you're training yourself to notice the right things and feel the right things and respond in the right ways in all these different and very difficult circumstances. You're aiming to hit the target. And so you're trying to get closer and closer to what that is. And yes, this is a process where you are very deliberate and you are very active, and you cannot, if at any point you throw up your hands and just say, well, this is the way I am, you're lost. But there's no reason to do that, Aristotle's going to say. Like, you have the power to do this. You have the power to do or not do, and you better go get it done. Okay, so any other thoughts about philosophical ideas, any other proposals for philosophical ideas that might underlie a fixed versus a growth mindset? Now,
I kind of think that the objectivist epistemology is more growth mindset, because concept formation is really a process from the objectives of epistemology, where you have ideas that, I guess one of the classic examples might be a definition of man as the creature that walks on two legs. And once you learn about chickens, you have to narrow that definition a little bit more.
Right. You know, this actually, I think you're getting actually to our second point, which I had labeled as intrinsicism about knowledge. Like, if you have this view that, well, like, really, you're just supposed to know things. Like, you should just be able to intuit things. You should just be able to see what the right answer is immediately without this process of coming to know things, without this spiral, then, yeah, you're going to think if you don't know it, like, you're just wrong. You're just incapable. You're just ignorant and, like, give up, right? But if you have this view, in contrast, and one of the things that comes with that, and I certainly had this a lot actually as a teenager and as a college student, if you have that view, then like any ignorance that you have, any mistakes that you make are really pretty shameful. Like they show, oddly, like mistakes and ignorance show that you're not smart. But smart here doesn't mean like having this intelligence, having this capacity. It means like knowing all the things and getting all the right answers, because, you know, that's what that should enable you to do. So on the other hand, if you have this view that your knowledge and your skills have to be cultivated and it's going to be this gradual process, you can expect to be ignorant a bunch of stuff until you go through that process. And even once you go through that process, you can expect to make a bunch of mistakes. That's going to lead to a kind of growth mindset about that. But I think oftentimes, like, I mean, I knew the objectivist theory of concepts while I still had this fixed mindset. Like, it took a while for me to work through that and really figure out, oh, wait, this is a... I've got a wrong view of knowledge here. I've got wrong expectations of myself.
And related to this, didn't Ayn Rand develop an idea about a frozen abstraction? And that, even linguistically, that sounds a lot like a fixed mindset.
So the frozen abstraction, I'm trying to think of what that is. Remind us, Arthur.
If I recall correctly, it's when you decide that a concept is just stuck with the definition that you've developed at a certain point and that you fail to further enhance and develop it with additional knowledge that you gain about it?
I don't think that's the frozen concept, actually.
I think
the frozen concept is like when you equate altruism with all of morality. And so that, like, that might be how you get at the frozen concept, in that you might have, like, at one point learned altruism as your moral theory, but then you never expand beyond that. Anyway, I think we'll have to debate this afterwards. We need to go look up a definition.
If only someone had access to the internet.
I know. Anyway, so I think it's really important as part of a growth mindset to understand that mistakes are inevitable, ignorance is inevitable. You have to go through this process in order to get knowledge and skills. Any other proposals?
I don't know if this is a philosophical principle, but if you're long ago in a civilization that's been unchanged for hundreds of years, that kind of encourages this idea that change isn't something possible, whereas now you see change all around you. I mean, of course, it's not automatic.
Right. I do think I've read enough history of the Middle Ages, and on this point, one thing really stuck with me, this idea that at the time, there was no, the idea of change was not a good thing, right? Because they had done things so the same way for so long that it didn't seem like if you changed it, it was likely going to get worse. Right, and so this, they didn't have this idea of progress, particularly not this inevitability of progress that we have today. And so that, like seeing that, and I also think that that gives us a certain view of the unknown. This is actually one of the things that's on my list, so thank you, Chris. There's people who view the unknown as scary and dangerous, and like just stay away. Like let's stick with what we know. And then there's people who are like, well, that's exciting. I don't know what's in there. Like, let's peer into that dark closet and see what's in there. Right? And that is, I think those are associated, or at least associated with a growth versus a fixed mindset. Liam?
I think religious concepts of salvation and reincarnation, those can kind of promote a growth mindset. The idea that, like, enlightenment, too. Like, if you, like, work hard to, like, follow your religious philosophy. I mean, that's
right.
But it'll still.
It depends on how, like, so are you familiar? There's a debate in Christianity with whether good works are required for salvation. So, and this is the scripture is actually unclear. Oh, good. Like we're doing Bible study. I'm so excited. Okay. So the scripture is unclear because
on Sunday, no less.
I know. The scripture is unclear because there's most of the time Jesus says like, believe in me and you will be saved. But there's the story of the lamb and the goats, which I'm not remembering the exact how the story goes. But there's the story of the lamb and the goats where basically it's very clear that good works are required too. And so there's this debate in Christianity, and there's been debate in Christian circles about like are good works required for salvation or not. And so if you have the view that it's just God's grace alone, like God's wish for you and it's set at birth, then it doesn't matter what you do, and that would promote a kind of fixed mindset, right? But if you have the view that it matters what you do in this lifetime, that your reward in the afterlife is in part going to depend on what you actually do day to day and whether you're a good person, I mean, we can disagree with our moral standards, but we can see that would create a kind of growth mindset. Like, I better make sure that I'm a good person. I better put the effort in. And this is why I think it's not just objectivists that have fixed versus growth mindsets. Like, you can have Christians with a fixed versus a growth mindset. Another one that I have listed here is your view about facts versus wishes. I'll get to you in a minute, Mike. So I think there's a kind of funny way that prioritizing wishes above facts can lead to a fixed mindset. So if you're, let's say you're trying to do something and it's not working, and if your dominant thought is, well, it just should be easy, and you just get mad at the fact that it's just not easy, I think this promotes a kind of fixed mindset. It's difficult to handle the fact that it's not easy because your focus is just on what you wish it would be and what your expectation was. On the other hand, and in a way, like, you literally can't even at that point, right? On the other hand, if you say to yourself, well, look, I thought it was going to be easy, like, I wish it was easy, but it's not, so I need to face these facts and figure out what it is that I need to do to get this done, that's the kind of attitude that you have toward if you have a growth mindset. So this attitude, really making sure to differentiate between your wishes and the facts, would seem to be one of the things that would contribute to a growth mindset. Mike?
I found the definition of the frozen abstraction.
Okay, go ahead.
Support Harper's. A fallacy, which may be termed the fallacy of frozen abstraction, consists of substituting some one particular concrete for the wider abstract class to which it belongs, e.g. substituting a specific ethic, altruism, for the wider abstraction of ethics. Thus, a man may reject the theory of altruism and assert that he has accepted a rational code, but failing to integrate his ideas, continues unfortunately to approach ethical questions in terms established by altruism.
I think we just both identified different aspects of the same thing.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
all
I
good.
See how that would
promote. All good. Another thing that I would say contributes
Can I cut in first?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the facts versus wishes thing is related to the objectivist epistemology point, especially what Natalie brought up earlier, because I think that one of the things here that's really important is differentiating between what your actual limits are versus what you think your limits might be. So oftentimes people can be very mistaken about what their actual limitations are, and when something gets hard, you start to think, oh, I can't do this. And sometimes they may not be right, but I think having this kind of rational, fact-oriented approach can help you to effectively and accurately differentiate between what is actually a limitation, whether genetic or otherwise, and what is actually within your power to change.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really difficult thing. It's one of the reasons. It's not just it's not just philosophically corrupt people that end up with fixed mindsets, right? There's mistakes that we make, ordinary, common, really routine mistakes that we make, where we think, well, this is just not the way that I am. I'm just not capable of doing this. And the result of that, if we're wrong, is a fixed mindset. And so I think that's actually really important. And sometimes you need to, like, maybe your goal is unrealistic. Maybe the way you're trying to achieve the goal is not working. There's all kinds of options there that I think you need to explore to make sure that you're not misjudging yourself there and setting limitations on yourself that are in fact not fact oriented.
I think Roger identified an important thing: objectivism's emphasis on keeping context. Because if you keep the full context of your situation, you're probably a lot more likely to honestly evaluate your capabilities. Like a lot of people who wrestle with psychological issues can get frustrated that stuff's not as easy for them. But that's because one's dropping the context that one's wrestling with something that's holding one back. So,
right.
Similarly in a lot of other areas. So.
Yeah, and there is that about mental issues too. There could be this idea of, like, why is this so hard? Right, and that's a matter of respecting the nature of the mind, and sometimes that's more difficult than you would like or you would expect. Okay, I just have one more that I want to talk about, and that is the nature of life. So, and this is pretty fundamental to the objectivist ethics. So if you view life as a kind of steady state or stasis or, you know, holding on, you know, or like waiting for the next life, that's more likely to yield a fixed mindset, because you're not out there like trying to do better, trying to push yourself, trying to make things better. You know, why exert an effort if you're just in a holding pattern? On the other hand, if you view life as requiring constant growth and striving, if you see that holding steady actually means sliding backwards, then in that case, that's going to promote a growth mindset, I think. Okay. So I do think there's lots of others. It was interesting when we discussed it. Like, at first, again, I was just in this kind of panic about, oh gosh, what am I going to say? But more and more came up. And I'd be interested, you know, as you go through life and you talk with people and you notice fixed and growth mindsets out there, I'd be interested to hear back from people about what you found that actually made a difference versus not, what you found that philosophical ideas that you've seen underneath. We're all done here. I think we've covered all the points, so take-home point?
Sure. What is your take-home point?
Okay. Fixed mindsets can be promoted by bad philosophical ideas, including determinism, intrinsicism, putting wishes over facts, viewing life as stasis, and fearing the unknown. If you want a fixed mindset, you need to project these ideas into your other ones.
Cool. Any follow-up questions? It's time for a reminder about the tip jar.
One free of charge, and that's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide. We do that with every show to thousands of listeners, but we can't accomplish that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans and not just to hold us up. So if you value our work, you can online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. And you can also create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal, Dwolla, or your bank's bill pay, and then you don't need to remember, and you get free access to Philosophy in Action's premium content, and we really appreciate that.
Do you also now take Square Cash?
I do take Square Cash, but it's not on the website because they don't allow me to specify amounts. So, but if you want to know my Square Cash tag, just shoot me an email, and I will make that happen for you.
Conga.
Yes. Hang on a second.
Question 2, John Paul's voter. Does John Paul's evil law restrict for not commercializing his voter? In Atlas Shrugged, John Galt went on strike when the world was lost in the day with him. They got really bad, so because Galt dismantled everything. If, instead of going on strike, he had quit the 20th Century Motor Company and started the Galt Motor Company, things seemed like they would have gone a very different way. By my reading, Galt's motor was pretty much a free energy miracle. Electricity would be too cheap to meter, and probably within a decade, the Galt Motor Company would provide the engines for every plane, train, automobile, and power plant in America. The resulting economic boom from ultra-cheap energy would have probably improved conditions. There'd be fewer calls for control. Other countries and demanded they liberalize their economies if they wanted him to electrify their countries. His wealth and influence would let him meet with titans of industries and convince him of his morality. He could invest in Hollywood and make movies and TV shows that showed his views. He could have met with her to realize that his morality was right. Her resistance was, after all, to the strike, not really to the idea that we should be selfish. People seem to be more panicky and politicians seem to get better. People who are well off don't cry out for a savior and accept whatever anyone tells them will make them better because things are going pretty well. Dagny and sparked a moral revolution all without dismantling civilization. Shouldn't he have? If his motor really could save everyone, and it seems like it could have, he is at least kind of a jerk to not commercialize it, and probably self-destructive too. So why go on strike at all?
So this is Josh Jobe's question. So Josh is not here today, but he is at AtlasCon. And so I have three major points I wanna make. So first of all, my first point is that people care a lot more about prosperity. And the big point about ours. Secondly, that John Galt doesn't have a duty to save other people. And that's also part of the point of Atlas Shrugged. And the third is sort of a meta point, so which is basically that while Atlas Shrugged is this great novel, it's actually not a good blueprint for how to save. So, okay. So should we go ahead and get started one by one here? Okay, so first of all, I really think there's this delightfully which I love, like it's so Josh in so many ways, and yet it I do really think it misses a big part of the point here. It assumes that wealth and prosperity are hugely important values that everybody cares about. It assumes that people are rational and they're rational. It assumes that people care deeply about human life and well-being in the way that all of us care about human life and well-being. And you know, that's just not true. And this is exactly Dagny's mistake throughout the novel. The slightly different view that, of course, these people, of course, the looters and the moochers, of course, they want to live. Of course, is another way of saying, of course, they care about life. They care about human life. They care about the lives of the people that are under their control. And what she has to discover is, in fact, no, they really don't. That's not their agenda. And I don't think that you need to think that people are acting on the death premise, which is what's happening in Atlas Shrugged, to think that people are prosperity here. In the realm of political economy, there's actually five major values that you see. I learned this at a conference. I have a book on it at home, and I can't recall what the title of the book is. But again, email me if you're interested in this. I will go look it up for you. Far left, this for the audience, you have equality. So, like, you have the rabid people who care about equality. The moderate left, which is people who are like, on the caring model. They're symbolized by a heart, right? Like, they want to make sure that the poor are cared for and so on. And so this kind of emotion is completely destroying them. It's not really a middle. You have the people who are money oriented in a way. It's economy oriented. These are people who want the wealth and prosperity. This is what matters to the most. That's what their core political value is. And this, I think, a lot of people who are pro business ideas are actually violating rights. Then you get to the right, and you see the more moderate people are law and order people. That's what matters to them. So a lot of the season in the debate this focus on, but these illegals, they're breaking the law. And you go, but look, the law is unjust. It's economically idiotic. This is the wrong law. And they're like, but they're breaking the law, because that's what their most fundamental value is. And it's not that concern for rule of law is wrong, it's not that caring for poor people is wrong, but caring about the plight of poor people and poor children is super wrong. But there's a misapplication of it in the political realm. And then on the far right, the thing that is really not so good is the faith, people driven by faith. So these are people who wish to impose their on and really the middle three, right? People can be mistaken about them. They can be wrong in all kinds of ways. But I don't think they're not equivalent to the death premise. But they're still, again, as I mentioned, they're still not the same as a commitment to individual rights. There'd be fewer calls for controls because everything would be going so swimmingly. That's assuming that everybody is on the money model, that's what everybody cares most about. But that's not actually true, because there's still going to be poor people on that model. There's still going to be so there's lots of people who are going to object to this, and we actually see this even in going really swimmingly. In Colorado, this massive boom of industry and people are moving there to get jobs and so on. And what happens? The controllers, the looters, they actually shut it down. And this was something. This was a point that Hank and Dax over a period of time, not something to them at the outset, but that was something that they had to learn. And you see this. You see this, Arthur, today.
Yeah. So. Backlash in San Francisco against tech workers, despite the fact that we're providing all these amazing values, and use those technologies to organize protests and to smash windows of buses, you know, transporting tech workers from, you know, one city to the other. And yeah, I mean, everything's amazing and nobody's happy.
The ways to look at wealth and technology and so on in the culture, its role in the culture, is as a kind of moral amplifier. In other words, they are not just intrinsically good, they're not always for the best. That you take a culture with bad fundamental values and you add a bunch of wealth and technology, you get a worse culture. Saudi Arabia is not better for all of their wealth. They're actually significantly worse in a lot of ways. And so I think that you can't take that as some kind of unquestioned good. You add free energy to a seriously corrupt culture. The world of where he talks about how only this was a prosperous street because only one in four shops were closed. The world of just read that and think about what it would be like to just add a bunch of wealth and technology. It would not necessarily be for the best.
Yeah, I mean, you can just look at what people are doing with technology today to promulgate
recycling.
All of their awful, awful views. Yeah, not resources to technologies that are not a particularly good use of
resources.
Those resources. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's the problem is not economic. It's philosophical. I mean, people's core values really matter.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I will also mention that the looters, and this is a point that John Galt makes when he's in captivity, the looters are always better playing the power game than an honest man is. You cannot outwit them, you can't outsmart them in that way. And I think that's something that you need to take account of. If Francisco couldn't do it, honestly, it would be so distasteful to do it. Like, that's not how I would want to live my life.
Yeah, raise your hand if you like going around manipulating people.
And Paul, you had made a point in our discussion about a businessman in Putin's Russia.
Like Josh Jobs or John Dahl, and you invented this awesome technology that made you a zillionaire, but you did it in Vladimir Putin's Russia, which is full of cronyism and corruption. Like, you think you could do it all this money I had in you would all of a sudden be a target. They would either eat you alive, or to the extent you survived, it would be by sort of playing their game, but basically everything you created would actually be used to further end you. And you live in Russia, don't release it there. I
would. Right. Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it would be like. About people caring about more than just wealth and prosperity. Second point that I want to make is that John Galt just doesn't have a moral duty. This is a point that you raised in discussion, so I think you get to take.
Yeah, so I think the way it was phrased in the opening question and closing question, which I won't repeat right now, is that the duty to benefit the rest of the world, and I think it's a kind of implicit altruism. Right? All that he did was withdraw. Right, he didn't go around destroying anything of anybody else's. Right, I mean, he encouraged people to destroy their own stuff, but I mean that's not the same thing as going around interfering in other people's things. And I don't think that a person is a jerk even to. I mean, let's say that you accept that he wasn't evil and so on, but I don't think it's being a jerk to refuse to associate with people who demand your stuff by right. Think that it's their right. How inclined are you to help them versus if they asked you, realizing implicitly that you absolutely have the right to say no? I mean, you're much more likely to be benevolent and generous in that situation. So which of these situations was Galt in?
Galt's not out there destroying anybody's property. He wasn't out there murdering anybody. He's not responsible for that. All he did, and this is part of the novel, is say, look, you guys have condemned us producers, as evil and wrong and immoral and exploiters. We're going to stop doing that. And one of the things that happened on Joshua's more recent Facebook thread on this was he said that Galt was, I don't actually know the exact wording, I should have looked this up, but that Galt basically killed all these people by the strike, which undoubtedly people but Galt is not responsible for that. And to call that killing, if you call that killing, it means that all of us are killers because all of us have done things like buy Starbucks rather than send that money to humanitarian causes that are helping, you know, people are easily curable. And so all of us, if that kind of inaction, if like failing to act on a duty of that kind makes us killers. That assumes a moral duty. That assumes a moral response. That everybody has a moral responsibility to save everybody else if they can. But that is definitely implicit altruism, and that's wrong.
It's not even implicit anymore.
Yeah. Atlas Shrugged is not reality, and it is definitely not a good blueprint for saving the culture. If you want to save the culture, the way to do it is not to implement this way. For a while, I've heard objectivists argue this way. Like, what we really need to do is make the public schools so bad. But still voting populist.
Well, but they are uneducated even with government schools.
They are uneducated, but they could, believe me, it could be way worse than it already is. And so, like, you do that, that's the path to dictatorship. If you have how good it is, and they demand more. And actually, if you want a revolution, one of the best ways of doing it is giving people a taste of freedom and then taking it away. And then they get out, like, they're out in the streets with their pitchforks. That's a, you know, that's actually, empirically speaking, that's how that happens. The other thing that looks like is productive output is not correlated with philosophical principles. So you look today at our most productive people in the economy, the people who are the movers and the shakers in the economy, the people who disappeared, you would feel their lack. And these are not people who have convince them to go on strike. That's not what would happen. And And so that's not realistic. And that's one of the reasons why I've been grappling this question of the role of philosophy in a person's life is not realistic. Now, I do think there is something that Hank and Dagnon could have done, which Josh actually advocates in here, which I would agree with, which they didn't do at all, which is speak up. Like, why weren't they out on, you know, television and media and, you know, we know that they can give a really good press conference. And but I think the reason that she didn't that is, I mean, like, she's got a literary goal here, right? And so putting that in would have completely complicated matters. It would have been fairly impossible. Right. But that's actually what Ayn Rand herself did, right? She didn't go on strike. She didn't try to create a strike. What she did was go out there and advocate better ideas, and I certainly think she's made a dent in the culture. And
the reason why Dagny and Hank weren't out there, you know, trying to promote the right ideas, I think that they did try that, but then you see how people fundamentally
Hank did some of that at his trial, but there was a public reaction in favor of him. But the businessmen were not, you know, they didn't support him. I don't think if they couldn't make the case then, it's not clear exactly is this going to work. Like if you couldn't convince them back then, like at Hank's trial, what is it that they're going to be convinced of now that they're completely desperate? It just, desperation does not make people more rational.
When he does go back to the world, it's not like the public is saying, do what they do with it.
Right. So I think that there's issues there. There's a couple cases where, like Dagny, like she thought about trying to say something, but she wouldn't, you know, like she wouldn't know what to say. And like, but generally, like she's not out there on, you know, she's not on, I mean, A, she's trying to run a railroad. Maybe she could find some better intellectuals somewhere and hire them. John Galt hasn't taken them already, right? But there's just not much public advocacy there. But oh, and it's not just her press conference. It's the radio broadcast she did, revealing which was brilliant. I mean, like, you could not see how she managed that. So and like, can't tell me Francisco could not have had like his own talk show and like, you know, really made a difference in culture. So
Sunday radio program or not?
Yeah, he might have had a I think he would have been doing better. Bigger things. At that point, like, I do think there's a lot of ways in which Atlas Shrugged is not realistic. It's not a blueprint. But I don't think that Josh's criticisms here are the ones that have merit.
So what's your take home point?
Yeah, so that was kind of it. But so John Galt was not evil. He was not evil. Wealth and prosperity. That's part of the point of Atlas Shrugged. And it's also because John Galt doesn't have a duty to others to save them, and that's also part of the point of Atlas Shrugged. But while Atlas Shrugged is a great novel, it's not a blueprint for cultural reform, so let's
question real
okay.
fast. One of your sub-points was that an economic downward spiral is not the path to freedom. But
okay.
I think sometimes if things get bad enough in certain respects, that can be a catalyst for people to wake up in respect. Do you think that's true? Do you think that, you know, what factors might contribute to that being an effective thing to capitalize on?
I mean, I certainly think you had mentioned in our discussion, and I had deleted it from the notes, sorry. But
that's
I do remember
it. Now.
I do remember it. That's certainly true. I mean, you look at the police shootings recently, and like, there's actually hope for some change in how policing is done in America. Like, maybe not as much as I would want, and there's a lot of mixed bag that goes along with that. But that seems possible. So I do think that these discrete events can be an issue, but I think that can be a catalyst. But that's different from the gradual downward spiral where everybody's just getting more and more desperate. But that, like, those discrete events, like, whether that results in that really depends on how the cultural debate goes about that and whether the right people are speaking up.
Does not make them choose a rational path.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you look at people who are even suffering in their private lives, you know, a child dies or something like that, and it's generally not, they do make more rational support than that.
An account of Cavendish, the scientist who made all the discoveries, and this connects with, why the connection with Josh's question in that it always, assuming the historical account I read was accurate, you know, held back on all of his discoveries, and it's taken me a while to realize, okay, that's not immoral. He didn't owe the world that, but I wonder about his rationality in that he was, you know, connecting with people. He discovered how to weigh the earth, and he was.
Right.
And so no one would ever know what he.
Right.
And then they didn't do it, so we ended
up
having
it. Yeah.
Having his
yeah.
Okay. So in spite of I mean,
well, I don't think I don't think that's a jerk, but being a misanthrope is not a good thing.
Right. That's
right.
It. I mean,
and I think for not producing the motor, that would have been wrong because humanity isn't that bad. And I don't know, maybe I'm in Dagny's position and I just don't really believe people are acting on the death premise, but I really don't believe people are acting on the death premise, not in the more traditional way. I just believe that people, like my high school biology teacher, who was a hardcore leftist, which I now know because I'm Facebook friends with her, like hardcore leftist, like, there are really great things about her. There's ways in which we do connect and values that we do share despite that. And so it's not that she's having a premise. I think she's just really got really bad values, and I'm pretty sure she seems thinks the same of me. But it's not, I don't have that kind of negative view of humanity that Ayn Rand did have. I just don't think people are acting on the premise. They last very long, which is probably a good thing.
So you'd say Cavendish was not acting on the death.
No, I don't think. Like, I think he was deeply mistaken, deeply misanthropic.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And in a way, like, what he was doing was definitely harmful to himself. But I think that I don't know. Maybe I need to think about that more. That would be a great question to submit for somebody to come up with you. Yeah. Tom.
Interesting observation. Even if John Galt were to have done all those things that Josh where you could see if you could kind of maybe get a hint of the results that would have happened regardless. So I can think of some individuals whose trade is the lifeblood of civilization oil, who donate to causes that support free market policy. Hollywood, and they're completely demonized, and you know,
right.
They say, Koch brothers, and all
right.
Of a sudden, boom.
Right.
So even if John Galt were to do all that stuff, there would be a lot of people out there, at least in the outer world right now, who would be like, free
yeah. I have an I Heart Fossil Fuels t-shirt from the Alex Epstein's organization, and so I bought it specifically so I could wear with Helga, which is my she's a medium duty truck, she's a toter home, so and I'm like wearing that even like when I'm going to truck stops, which is where we have to gas up, like, and that says something about the state of our culture with respect to that, and yet like where would we be without those fossil fuels, Conga?
Question 3, acting rightly. How can I learn to act rightly, self-interest and self-esteem, yet I don't act on these beliefs? Right now, I don't have any self-esteem. Once I act upon believing in reality instead of merely believing in it, I will develop self-esteem. But I'm really lost as to how to apply reality in my life. I don't know what that would mean.
little bit short on details. So I found it a bit difficult to understand exactly what's being asked. But Arthur, you had an easy take on it that I think is right.
Yeah, I think this sounds like I've accepted these ideas, but I don't know what they mean in practice. And I think that's a pretty understandable and fair question.
Yeah, there's certainly lots and lots of people who embrace ideas on the surface. Well, any idea of what they would really mean or any attempt to actually apply them in their lives, and then they're like, I'm an objectivist or I'm a Christian, and you look, you scratch a little bit, and you're like, ew, what is that under there? And they don't notice it. For over 2 decades, I'm still learning stuff. So, don't think that. Well, this is such a newbie question. I don't have anything in common with this person.
Yeah. So, how could someone who's new to these ideas and maybe they resonate with him, like,
think about reality and then act on what you know? why would that be hard? Yeah. No, that's not it. That's not gonna do. We need some concrete strategies here. And these are the same strategies that we all need to employ in our daily life. So again, even if you've been doing this for and here my audience, you guys can jump in or just raise your hand. I'm gonna get started with number one and then feel free to chime in. So I think it's really important as a starter for thinking about like reality, right? For thinking about the prime theory.
Which basically means make sure that, you know, what you wish is the case, you know, is not confused for what the case actually is.
Yeah. Yeah. So I might not want to work on some project, say I've got some editing work to do. I could be out riding horses or, you know, laying about watching TV or doing any number of other things. I really wish that. But the fact of the matter is, that I need to recognize here. So differentiating my wishes about things from the facts about things. Clearly make sure that I am, in general, putting my emotions over here and facts over here, and not that one is necessarily like always going to trump the other. Not that I have to say, well, it's a deadline and I can't possibly do anything about it and I have to act on so that's the first one. The second one is also on an emotional point, is be alert to nagging thoughts and feelings. So, you know, is there something that you're avoiding thinking about that you don't think about yourself? That's a big red flag, and particularly be aware of evasion, of that feeling of, I don't want to look at that, I don't want to think about that. Like, let's not examine that. Let's go over here because that's really painful. Thoughts or feelings too. This is both important. Conscious judgment. So you think, for example, that you should want this promotion because it's a bigger salary and it's a fancy title. And yet part of you is dreading it. And you don't just want to run over that emotion, and you don't just want to go with that emotion. You actually underlying the emotion, am I not thinking through this well enough? You need to figure out what's up when you have those kinds of conflicts.
Yeah, and I think an emotion to be particularly attuned to is when you're feeling guilt, because that can be a very big clue that
yeah, and between what you feel like you should do and what you're doing.
Right, and either could be wrong, right? Like, your feelings about what you should do could be wrong, or maybe your rational convictions are wrong, or, you know, on any level, you know, there could be some kind of conflict. The point is, it should be a trigger for you to impact on what's going on with you.
Yeah. So, along a similar, like, I sort of feel like we're going down a path, so along a similar vein, I think it's really important to articulate your reasons for your choices, to know why you're doing. Either from a non-philosophical kind of perspective, or from a very different philosophy, or just in general, you've been cruising along in life. It's really easy to make decisions without thinking seriously about what your reasons are. really want to make sure that you're going with your best rational judgment, when you're going by the facts rather than by your emotions, you know, just your default philosophical assumptions. So look for rational reasons for doing things, meaning reasons based on facts. And sometimes one of the things you can do is talk this over with other people, because things can sound normal in your head and then you say another person. And so, for example, like if you are dating somebody and you're really drawn to them and you like maybe you don't quite know why, right? Now is the time to step back and say, okay, like what is it about this person that I really like? What is it? Are there things that I don't like? Are there red flags here? Like what is
it'll all be.
Let's do one rapid fire, and can we please do the first one?
It's time to put Diana in the hot seat. I'm asking questions from the rapid fire queue, and questions that you post right now in chat too. No, I'm not. Diana doesn't know what the questions will be asked. Yes, she does. And I'm going to try to trip her up. I don't know how. I am, reluctantly, but strongly considering voting for Hillary Clinton in 2016. Can you think of a better alternative?
Yes. Like, wait. Like, this is ridiculous. Like, we have, like, not everybody has even declared themselves. We don't know who the two primary, like, Republican, Democratic candidates are. Like, you don't.
Thing all the time, always,
yes.
And declare it to the world.
Yes, that is true. But nonetheless, the opinion on this is do not decide now. I have made exactly zero Facebook posts on the 2016 election. And I'm very proud of myself for this. I've been tested. But I'm going to continue about it. I might be on the show about candidates and what I think their strengths and weaknesses are, like an analysis like I did last year. But I would really just like to not get caught up at all in this election. Because who the heck cares? I mean, like, it's gonna be who the heck cares. Right? So it's important to still super tiny and it really doesn't matter, and it's all going to suck. And, like, whatever, because it doesn't really affect me all that much.
Well, I think maybe in a later show, we should maybe address why the heck cares.
Yeah, that was good. I talked about that. I did an interview with Eric Daniels on why voting doesn't matter. So, that's my answer to this. Go listen to Eric's podcast, or my interview with Eric on that. And
But I think there's also a difference between voting doesn't matter and we shouldn't care who is.
No, I agree. Like, I care. I just And, you know, like, it would have been really great if Obamacare had been able to be repealed or not passed at all. Or, you know, like, it's not that things do not matter. Things matter, and that was unfortunate that happened and that can't – it's not going to be done. But it's really fair to find, like, what else has Obama done that has been that bad during his administration that somebody like George W. Bush would not have also done? Like,
don't look at me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just like, there's just been, like, both of them, George W. Bush and Obama, did a better job. And different flavors. So try not to sweat it. And if you're going to be involved in politics, don't worry about the national election. Worry about local and state elections. No follow-ups at all. Sorry, on the rapid fire. Okay. We'd better close up because we are late.
To sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. Thanks for listening. We hope you had a great time.
So I had a fantastic time, and sorry to the people who were listening. I have a lot of audience, which is so much fun. And once again, thank you to our generous contributors. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you ideas that engage the mind and help you live better. Plus, we introduce thousands of other listeners to the people who need to live better. contribute, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support. And also, I have, for those of you who are actually here, signing and selling, and so that I would very much like to get rid of, in fact, because I have no room in my suitcase. So by all means, please, if you're interested in the copy, come and get that after the show.
Strike a hard bargain.
I'm Arthur Zay. This show features Dr. Dutch.com/blog. Please drop by to submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows, and then join us live here at the same time next week at Philosophy in Action.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.